At this point, the first side of the tape ran out, and they turned the tape over, but a little discussion seemed to have been dropped on the floor in the process, so we resume where they did.
We're being flooded, feasted, inundated with gifts from the universe in the form of everything that you, your sense organs and your knowledge technology picks up. So everything I do is involved in information, and information technology, software programs for computers, and tape recording interviews, and using using the old printing press as a method of
getting it out.
Yeah, getting signals out and inviting. I do a lot of college lecturing, a lot of TV activity. Because it's the ultimately thrilling activity of someone who possesses a brain like ours. I feel very contented that I think I'm one of the first members of the information society of the future. Just as the first settlers in America felt they were the beginning of a new continent of space and land and mountains and forests that they could, that's a background for which they can express their visions of a Puritan society or of a Pennsylvania Quaker society or a Thomas Jefferson democracy or whatever. I'm one of the first explorers of the info world, both of the brain and of the info world defined by our quantum technologies, so, computers and television. And it's a glorious position to be in, to have discovered with many of my fellow navigators and inhabited and settled in what's going to be the new terrain for our species. So it's a thrilling position to be in.
I happen to reread Prescription for Rebellion by Robert Lindner. Again, I think it was published in 52.
Prescription for what?
Rebellion.
Written by whom?
Robert Lindner, the 50-Minute Hour, remember him?
Yeah.
And Rebel Without a Cause. In that book, 1952, I was quite shocked to see what he was saying. He was saying, hey, you know, we have reached the limits of our physical, if you would, exploration on this planet. And if we don't want our society to degenerate, we need to teach people how to rebel, and teach them how to rebel usefully and creatively, and at the next level, since we have expanded, if you would, our physical dimensions in this planet, is in the area of, if you would, psycho models. Okay, and I was quite pleased to see that he was there in 52. And I sort of relate that to what you're saying now. He said, if we don't do that, we're going to collapse in on ourselves. And he used actual models from physics to demonstrate that.
He was certainly a prophetic person. And there were many people saying the same thing. Chris McLuhan said the same thing. There were, and throughout human history, certainly during the entire industrial age, people have been pointing to the horrors of an insectoid factory society. Mm-hmm. Ian Blake was among the first, and all the English romanticists. So that, Lindner, he became very, I think, very puritanical and very crotchety in many ways. He was very supportive for censoring comic books. Remember that?
Mm-hmm.
And he was totally against individuals using drugs for their own self-enhancement. So that he, on one hand, he was a very, very prophetic. I think he's also limited by
His Freudian preoccupation.
Highly moralistic, Viennese, Freudian, Jewish limitation. But I think he gave all of us at one point a little boost in the right direction, and some more power to him. And
I felt
pay tribute to his memory.
I felt supported by him during the 60s, if you would, the early part of the 60s, I felt supported by his work. I felt that he was saying, hey guys, you don't have to follow the paths that everyone else has laid out there for you. Go out there and see what you can find
that
for yourself.
That has to be said in every generation, in
over and over again.
Rock musicians and psychiatrists and authors. I agree.
So, let me see, we discussed three, and I guess we have two left, neuropolitics, and the intelligence agents. That makes the five of the series.
Intelligence Agents is a wonderful book. It again takes up the notion of stages or steps or periods of evolution, but it approaches it from the standpoint of neurogeography or the demographics of human migration. And there's some wonderful chapters in there about intelligence and human evolution moving from east to west, and the gene pools are moving up through Europe and around Africa. And I define the stages of evolution in geographic terms, and that when you're in California, you are in the 1980s, and you go back east, and you go back every one of the time zones, Pacific Mountain, Eastern, it's like a century, so you say that you'd be going back to Washington, B.C.
Right, Washington, B.C., right.
It's encouraging migration and encouraging leaving the old gene pools and carrying the best of your own gene pools, whether it's Jewish or Armenian or Arabic or Irish, forward to the Western future. It's also a very funny book, and it's much more elegant than exopsychology.
And then we have neuropolitics, nervous politicians.
Neuropolitics, as its title suggests, is concerned with the politics of the period 1976 to maybe 80, when the book came out. Part one is called The Twilight of Terrestrial Politics, and it talked about the 60s and the Watergate scandal and Gordon Liddy's first attempts to harass us, and discusses Manson and brainwashing and the fall of representation of government. And there are many chapters which give you anecdotal reports on my personal encounters with FBI spies and people like Liddy. It's somewhat a lighter book than the other volumes in the Future History series. The most important stuff in this book to me is it predicts the government of the information age. There's a chapter called The Fall of Representational Government, when it says the process of selecting representatives to govern is a relic of the horse-drawn culture which produced the American Constitution, which is totally out of date in an info-electronic society in which everyone should be televoting at least once a week, not on parties or partisan issues, but on the issues themselves.
Yeah, issues and ideas.
Yeah.
Right.
So that this book, by the way, is probably the most pop book I've ever written, because most of the articles appeared in magazines like, I think Playboy and We and, excuse me.
The ringing phone interrupted their discussion, but when they came back, Dr. Hyatt asked Dr. Leary what his thoughts and feelings were about the Future History series. And here's where we pick it up.
They're basically archaeological relics. Not very useful today, except that they spell out the steps that we took as a species to get where we are today. A Paleolithic bone knife not very useful in your kitchen today. Mm-hmm. There's extraordinary importance in showing where it came from and when it came from, and it becomes a step in a series of artifacts and tools that led from stones
to right.
bone knives mm-hmm. to bronze to steel to microwaves. So that I feel the books in the Future History series are important archaeological relics, which allows to reconstruct, I think, the essence of history in the last 30, 40 years. I'm very proud of them.
Well, we enjoy them. I've read them now.
Yeah.
One last question. What other books are you doing, June?
I'm writing a book called The Cyber Society, colon, the personalization and popularization of electronic knowledge technology in the roaring 20th century. And it's a book about the information society and the cyber individual society of the present. And I'm having a lot of fun with it.
Good, good. Just for my own information, you know, I used to do some reading with, read Henry Stack Sullivan years and years ago. And your wheel, as I call it, seems to have a strong historical connection to some of the work that Henry did along the same lines.
Who did that?
Henry Stack Sullivan.
Harry.
Yeah.
Harry Stack Sullivan.
Harry, I'm sorry. Yeah. And I noted it in another book, and I was quite pleased to find that maps of the mind, or maps of consciousness. Are you familiar with that book?
By Metzner?
Yeah. No, not by Metzner. You were given 2-3 pages on your so-called Leary's grid, okay? And I wanted to get your feeling as to what's happening with Leary's grid. Is it still being used in the academic world? Are people using it in so-called private practice? Is more research being done on that? Are you doing anything with it other than mind mirror?
There you go, 9 questions in a row here.
Of course.
The interpersonal system for measuring human behavior, of course, Einsteinian, that is, you could only measure a person's behavior in terms of other people.
Mm-hmm.
You can only diagnose a patient in terms of his or her relations with the people, starting with the therapist and then going out to important people in the immediate situation, of course, going back to people in the past. The interpersonal theory derives from Harry Sack Sullivan, who was a genius, eccentric, non-mainstream psychiatrist,
mm-hmm.
who was famous for a brief time in the 40s. He was an anecdotal psychiatrist and had no scientific sense. So as a graduate student, a group has took up Sullivan's theories, which are basically Einsteinian, relativistic, or as we'd say now, interactive. And we tried to make them scientific. Of course, if you're going to study human relations, the best model for doing it is nuclear physics, where you're studying particles as they intersect and collide and fuse and diverge. So we developed a psychological system which is basically psychogeometrical.
Mm-hmm.
Are you above or below? Are you coming towards or coming away? And it became a compass reading of your attitude towards other people. Attitude in the navigational sense of angle of approach to others. Everything, it turns out, is geometrical. As Einstein says, as quantum physics says, and as astrophysics says, you might measure anything in terms of where it is in terms of other moving bodies. So psychogeometry was the great contribution I made in the 1950s. This concept and the TESS, so-called wheel, the wheel is simply a compass.
Mm-hmm.
You plot human behavior on the wheel the way you would plot the movement of boats on a navy radar screen. This had a life of its own and was used literally thousands of clinics and research centers, and it has been the interpersonal psychogeometric way of measuring human movement became popular again in the form of a computer software program called Mind Mirror.
I've used it.
Mm-hmm. The computer is ideally set up to allow human beings to digitize their thoughts and to move them around screens that intersect and have your thoughts collide, or to communicate thoughts. I can put my thoughts on a screen and you can put your thoughts on a screen and we can see how they
disparity and
intersect.
Yeah. Yeah.
So this whole notion of interpersonal psychology translated into thoughts moving on screen is a nice...
I'm planning to experiment with it. I'm going to be reopening a small private practice here when I move back, and I plan to be doing a number of new things.
Yeah.
with the practice, including using that and a few other computer games that I found that seemed to be quite interesting.
Nightmare could be an incredibly interesting tool.
What limitations did you find with it? What would you like to have done more with that game?
Well, that was the first step.
Mm-hmm.
And it was primitive in many ways. It was like a Model T Ford. Or it was like a Wright Brothers plane. We bailed it together with a wire and paper clips and fluid up there, and it landed. It was very limited because there are only 64 personality types based upon 8 elements which mm-hmm. interact. And we force these choices or these variables or these ideas on the person. The person could select any subject, but the attributes we selected. We're working on new versions of Mind Mirror called a head coach, which any thought you have and any attributes you have can be put on screen, so it becomes an electronic database of your own mind, or it becomes
an infinite correlation matrix.
Yeah, it's a relational database in which every thought you ever want to have or have had can be stored, and if the Library of Congress can do it for society, or if the Smithsonian Institute does for society, you should do it for yourself.
Yes, I agree. This is an old idea for me, as an example. When I was in graduate school, I developed what I called nonsense correlation tables, correlating the number of bananas bought with the number of people drinking iced tea on Monday morning, okay? And just did infinite maps, mind maps, using Osgood's stuff and other people's stuff. And I'm quite pleased to see someone finally doing that in the real world and making it useful.
My work in psychogeometry, of course, was very similar to Osgood's stuff with the semantic differential.
Yeah, he was one of my heroes. I published lots of articles on his stuff.
Did you really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that. Yeah. And another man named George Kelly at Ohio State, who developed the theory of personal constructs.
Mm-hmm.
Personal constructs is your ideas.
Right.
That's Heisenberg. The world is made up of your constructs of it.
Mm-hmm.
So that George Kelly and Osgood, stemming from the works of Harry Stack Sullivan, were all led up to my work, and I pay great tribute to these men.
I had one book published on my about 20 or 30 journal articles I did using Osgood's semantic differential in mapping person perception.
Mm-hmm.
How people perceived other people using an Osgood scale. There was one book published on it in England over at Hans Eysenck's Institute, University of London.
Eysenck was interesting in that he was a very sound psychometrician, but he was an old school industrial managerial type and quite fascist.
Mm-hmm.
See, what we were doing was giving the power to the individual. Undercutting the roles of doctor, patient, or scientist. Everyone had to become a scientist.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone had to become your own psychologist.
Right.
You plot your own thoughts. Eysenck was extremely manipulative and exploitive, although I did admire him just at the level of...
what he was doing. He was trying to make something useful.
He was getting out in the numbers.
Right.
If you're working with numbers, at least you've taken one step away from the oral tradition. And
that's
the,
I firmly believe that that what we need, quote, in the private practice world is a new psychology, if you would, a new psychotherapy. You might want to even call it psychogeometric therapy or astrotherapy or something.
Yeah, and of course the information age stuff fits in there. I'm going to let you see what they're doing.
Mm-hmm. One of the reasons I left therapy 12 years ago, I went traveling and developed Balkan Press, was I got fed up with the type of relationships and the type of expectations both I had and the patients had. Of playing Mr. Authority.
Well, group therapy, see, is excellent.
Yeah.
And family therapy. And there's a clinic in Burbank called the...
California Family Studies?
That's based upon my own work, the guy that founded it. And they call it a systems approach. That is, you never see the individual patient or client. It's always with the boyfriend or the family or mm-hmm. the mother or the father. And you get everybody, because it's been really good to change one, because the rest are going to close ranks and make sure that no changes occur. So you got to have the whole system changing at once. It's basically Einsteinian, it's basically interactive.
Mm-hmm. I think you might enjoy Stephen Heller's book over there, because
I will.
He talks about all those models and maps and using how he uses hypnosis in a much different way than has previously been used. You might say in a more soft way.